Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Montana Governor Steve Bullock, contender for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 presidential race. Governor Bullock talks about his history of winning elections in a largely red state, which voted for the current president by a 20% margin. He also talks about the need to get corruptive influences and dark money out of politics, and his vision for how to improve healthcare and the need to address climate change. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with presidential candidate Montana Governor Steve Bullock on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who is currently running for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. Prior to his election in 2012, Governor Bullock served as Montana's Attorney General, where he launched efforts to combat Citizens United. Previously, he ran a law firm in Montana after having practiced law in Washington, D.C. Governor Bullock also taught as an adjunct professor at the George Washington University School of Law. He recently completed his tenure as chair of the National Governors Association. He earned his BA in politics and economics from Claremont McKenna College and his law degree with honors from Columbia Law School in New York. Governor Bullock, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be with you both, for sure.
Yeah. And first of all, congratulations on your candidacy. Mm-hmm. You're part of a significant group of Democrats who are battling for the 2020 presidential nomination. And you're a Democrat in Montana, a state that went heavily for President Trump, and yet you won by a sizable margin. Talk to our listeners about your ability to bring voters from different backgrounds together. What makes you uniquely qualified as a presidential candidate, and what are some of the motivating forces behind your decision to run?
Sure, yeah, and I appreciate that. I was the only actually Democrat in the country to get reelected in a state in 2016 where Donald Trump won. He took Montana by 20 points. About 25 to 30% of my voters voted for Donald Trump. And it's more, Mark, than just winning an election. You know, my legislature, in my 6 years that I've been here, has gone from at times about two-thirds Republican to about 60% now. But somehow we've been able to get some of that politics out of there and actually get progressive and meaningful things done, like healthcare or funding for education, kicking dark money out of our elections. So some of the unique qualifications I bring to a big field is, if we can't win back some of the places that we lost in 2016, we're not going to win this race. I mean, I've said to people, I assure you that if I'm the nominee, I will win California, Massachusetts, Vermont. But we have to make sure that whoever is the nominee can also win places like in Montana or Iowa or Michigan or Wisconsin, because it does come down to math. I think far too often, Washington, D.C. is kind of a place where talking becomes a substitute for doing. I don't have the luxury of just giving big speeches, right? I have to see my constituents each and every day, and they expect me to deliver. And that's deliver everything from the services they expect out of government, but also deserve forward movement from government. So I think I do bring some things both geographically, generationally, and being able to win the sort of places that we need to make sure that we can win in 2020, if we're going to win this race.
Well, Governor Bullock, you've said that you have some very good reasons for entering somewhat late into this political fray. And certainly earlier this year, we know you were very focused on the Medicaid expansion in your state. Maybe you could talk with us a bit about what must have been a bit of an odyssey. The most important thing is you were successful. Those tens of thousands of people got coverage. So the question is, is there a playbook that comes out of this for how to work across party lines?
Thanks, Margaret. And I think that there are. And actually, yeah, I signed my last bill on Monday, and I announced on the Tuesday thereafter. So on the one hand, you know, you could go back. Bill Clinton didn't even get in until October the year before. But we actually first got Medicaid expansion passed in 2015. And we were going to reauthorize it by ballot initiative in 2018. But tobacco companies actually spent $26 million killing that reauthorization. So 2 months after that is when our legislature started. I had to make sure to get that through because there are 100,000 Montanans, the vast majority of whom are working.
Right.
They rely on that health care. But I think the model, even when we got through in 2015, a time where Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act wasn't quite viewed as favorably as it was is even today.
Right.
How we got it through is by doing a number of things, one of which is not making it all about the battle at the state house, but by going to rural communities. And I'll never forget, I was in this one at Shoto, Montana, where about population 1,700, where during a town meeting, when the hospital administrator said, you know, 43% of the people who walk through those hospital doors don't have health insurance. Or the county commissioner noted that he had been born in that hospital, and if they lost that hospital, they'd lose that town. So instead of making it about any sort of politics, but about the importance of healthcare, in 2019, also did a big study and figured out that 57% of the businesses in the state have one or more employees on Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a program for, you know, those that aren't that wealthy or not working. It's also taking care of employers that unfortunately are unable or unwilling to pay their employees enough to have quality health care. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in Montana with 100,000 folks covered, 30,000 more have gotten mental health treatment, 10,000 substance use disorder. We've actually made a state website that shows county by county the sort of preventative treatments people are getting along the way, because we know that, you know, one way or another, right, that we're all going to take care of folks that don't have health care.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's pull the thread a little on the health care conversation. Certainly, we hear a number of candidates calling for Medicare for all. And there are others that have more sort of a moderate but progressive approach, opting to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. And I'm wondering how you would describe your plan.
I think that we all hopefully agree that healthcare should be affordable and accessible for all. And by the Affordable Care Act, which I think was actually the greatest advance in healthcare since Medicaid and Medicare were first passed. And Medicare is an example, you know, we've been continually building onto along the way. We still have about 25 million folks that aren't covered. Now, if we could expand Medicaid in the rest of these states, that would cover about half. But what I would do is actually build on the Affordable Care Act. Let's not start all over. And what I would do is a public option, first of all, an option where individuals could actually buy health insurance from the government instead of just the private market. Second, which it is just a shame. Well, it's actually embarrassing that like Costco could negotiate for prescription drug prices, but it's still legal at the federal level.
Yeah. Right.
And it kind of shows the corrupting influence of money in the
right.
system. I think we could end surprise medical billing and out-of-network charges with legislation at the federal level. I don't think that the best policy or the best political solution, if we actually want to win this election, is to tell about 180 million people that have employer-sponsored health care that we're going to take all that away and that there will be no more a private market in this. I don't think that's the best policy, because once people dig into what that might look like, you know, often the great majority of folks say, that's not the direction that I want to go. So we have made great strides. We still have a lot further to go, but I don't think just tearing it all down and starting all over, at least from my perspective, would be the best way to go.
Well, Governor, you've had, I think, the incredible opportunity and given the incredible service as chair of the National Governors Association. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine a chance to, you know, work shoulder to shoulder with other leaders about some of the unique challenges that are faced by the rural states in our country, particularly around healthcare, delivering healthcare in rural regions. Share with our listeners the solutions that you've advocated for around improving healthcare access in the rural states, and what would you continue to advocate for as president? And are there some bold new initiatives that you think rural America needs relative to healthcare?
You bet, Margaret. And we have about 20% of the rural hospitals right now at risk of closing in this country. And if you lose a rural hospital, that town's gone. The viability of that community is at so much greater risk. So I think we have to do everything from ensuring there are ways that we have providers there to ensuring the way that there's financial viability. I mean, a state like mine in Montana, we actually have two residency programs. You know, one is a primary care residency, but we just started the one in psychiatry as well, because we know if an individual does a residency program in a community or in a region or in an area, they're so much more apt to stay. We've done both psychiatry and some other things through a program called Project Echo, where it's essentially building case teams and doing work online to sort of bridge some of these rural gaps or the large geographic gaps, especially in areas where, because it's often mental health providers that are that much more challenged. I think we also have to look at reimbursement rates for our rural communities, because at times they should be higher than their urban areas, just because you can't lose that connection in rural areas, or it really does gut out places. We've done loan forgiveness programs when it comes to rural areas. And the biggest and I think most important is the viability of Medicaid programs. Making sure that you have Medicaid expansion, because where if you have so many folks that don't have coverage and you don't have a reimbursement rate through Medicaid expansion, it's that much harder for those smaller communities and those rural hospitals to stay open. So I think those are just kind of the base level, you know, and even in some ways transcends beyond just healthcare to make sure that you're doing everything from solid internet connectivity to creating job opportunities with either community foundations or our smaller two-year and four-year colleges, because nobody should have to leave, right? The place that either they're raised or the place that...
Or the place they love, right.
Or the place they love, for sure.
Well, we're speaking today with Montana Governor Steve Bullock, contender for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 presidential campaign. Prior to his term as governor, he served as Montana's attorney general and was instrumental in the Citizens United case. And Governor, I think it's fair to say you've had a clarion voice on this about the sort of the ironclad grip that big money has on lawmakers. You point specifically to the National Rifle Association, which just a few weeks ago seemed to have managed to influence the president to back away from his pledge to promote universal background checks for gun buyers after devastating back-to-back mass shootings. You're pro-Second Amendment, and you say we must address the nation's gun violence epidemic as a public health issue. And I'm wondering if you could just talk to our listeners a little bit about where you come from on this issue.
Yeah, and you bet, Mark. And where you start out was sort of the corrupting influence of money in our system. That really has been the fight of not only my 10 years in public office, but I think it's a challenge of our time. You go anywhere from gun safety to climate to why can't we negotiate prescription drug prices? And so much of it is, I think, because in this post-Citizens United world, Washington, D.C.'s influence, and in too many states, are basically it's written by the donors. So we have to address that if we're going to address anything else. As you know, I am a gun owner. I hunt. 40% of households in this country, there's a firearm. But I'm also a father. I'm also someone that's tired of lowering flags as a governor, tired of my children having to learn active shooter drills. And if we could ever look at it as a public health issue, not as a political issue, we could make substantial progress. And when I was growing up, the National Rifle Association was gun safety, it was a hunting, it was a shooting organization. Now it's nothing more than a political organization. Use to divide us. Like, I'll give you 30 million reasons why Donald Trump is doing exactly what he's doing. And that's the $30 million that they spent on his election. I remember back right after the Parkland shootings, all the nation's governors were in the White House for National Governors Association. At that time, President Trump had said, we should look at universal background checks. Within a week, he reversed after he spoke to the NRA. I've lowered the flag seven times since then. He did the same thing right after El Paso and Dayton. A public health issue would look at it as saying there are steps that we can take, like universal background checks. Vast majority of NRA members and Republicans think that, that would be a good idea. A public health issue would say safe storage, would say red flag laws, the ability to remove a gun where, you know, there's concerns that have been raised. And look, even the state of Indiana passed red flag laws. They're not the crazy liberal state. Well, I'm confident when I win that I can get some of that ground, but I don't think we should even wait until then. I mean, gun owners need to be calling on folks as well in D.C. to make some meaningful change, because I think we're all just tired of worrying about both our kids and the safety of our communities.
Well, Governor, I think one of the areas where you've really led is making this connection between some of these major social problems that are facing us and recognizing that they have a huge tie to public health. And two areas that you've really led on were the areas of protecting the environment and also the reproductive health rights of women. Tell us, what are some of the policies that you are really advocating for?
Here I am out in the West as an example, and fire seasons are 78 days longer than they were 40 years ago. I mean, we need to take immediate and durable action when it comes to climate. Mm-hmm. And I'd certainly rejoin the Paris Accords. I would turn around and say it was great 2 weeks ago when even the auto industry said they didn't want to roll back these fuel efficiency standards, right? The scientists say that as a world, we have to be essentially carbon neutral, net zero by 2050. Two things. I mean, one of which is the federal government has to be a partner and has to be investing money both in research and development. Another thing, though, that we don't always talk about is, even that first George Bush, when he was president, he said, we'll address the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. I mean, here was a Republican president saying we have to address climate change. Now, Republicans won't even acknowledge that climate change is real and human caused. So we have to break those links because we can't wait another 30 years. When it comes to the second issue that you raised, Margaret, we've been over 45 years with Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. My whole time in public office, I've protected the woman's right to make her own health care decisions. That's the decision a woman should make in consultation with her doctor, and if she so chooses, her family and her faith. But it shouldn't be the decision that I'm making. And we need to figure out when it comes to reproductive health, when it comes to health care overall, we stop playing the politics and say, well, let's empower the women.
Governor, I wanted to get back to an earlier point on the politics. You're not on the next debate. We're months and months away before the first vote is cast in Iowa. And then we've got all the rest of the states to deal with it. And sort of, how are you addressing this issue? And how are you making an effort to reach out past the nationally televised debates? Where do you think you go from here?
On the one hand, I think that maybe the DNC's rules of getting 130,000 donors was well-intentioned, but what it really has done is made campaigns spend all of their time and a lot of money on Facebook and Google instead of actually spending that money connecting with voters. So hopefully I'll be on the following debate stage, and if folks go to stevebullock.com, that helps. But I think that another thing that you point out, Mark, we're still over 150 days from any voter expressing their preference. It's those early states that take a big field and bring it down to a smaller size. And then as you go throughout the primary, then voters can really take a look at it. I mean, John Kerry was at 4%, 31 days out from the Iowa caucuses. And it's the caucus goers that make those decisions. Yeah. So I'm in the, 15 or 16 weeks I've been in this. Been to Iowa on 10 separate trips there. I've been to New Hampshire a number of times. Continue to make sure that voters know they're the ones that get to make these decisions. And I trust the voters' decisions in that.
We have been speaking today with Montana Governor Steve Bullock, contender for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 presidential campaign. You can learn more about his work by going to stevebullock.com or follow them on Twitter or Facebook at Governor Bullock. Governor, thank you for your dedication to public service, for your commitment to the American experience, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Laurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Laurie, what have you got for us this week?
The Affordable Care Act's open enrollment period for most states is coming up, running from November 1st to December 15th. Let's take a look at how coverage of the uninsured has changed since the ACA was enacted in 2010. The National Health Interview Survey's most recent report shows that in 2010, 16% of the population, or 48.6 million people, were uninsured at the time they were interviewed. That figure dropped by 20 million to 28.6 million uninsured people in 2016. Since then, under President Trump, the figure has crept up, rising by 1.8 million people to an estimated 30.4 million uninsured. A much greater recent rise was reported by a Gallup survey. Gallup put the rise in uninsured adults at about 7 million compared with the last half of 2016. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has used a much higher figure that includes the underinsured. He said in the last presidential debate that there were 87 million uninsured or underinsured in the country now. A Commonwealth Fund study supports that figure. The study found, quote, of the 194 million U.S. adults ages 19 to 64 in 2018, an estimated 87 million were inadequately insured. The 87 million figure includes 24 million uninsured in 2018, 43.8 million who were underinsured. The underinsured measure includes people whose out-of-pocket costs were 10% or more of household income over 12 months. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Laurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Vaccinations are considered one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century, reducing fatalities from most common and fatal diseases by up to 99%. But in the 21st century, some of those numbers just aren't stacking up. As recently as 2009, only 45% of the nation's preschool-age children had received all of their recommended vaccinations and boosters. And researchers at the Children's Outcome Research Program at Children's Hospital in Colorado decided to take an in-depth look at the problem. Dr. Allison Kemp heads up the Children's Outcome Research Program, and she conducted a study on what would help to generate better compliance with the required vaccinations. And she found that when parents received timely reminders from their state and local health departments, parents were much more likely to get the vaccinations and boosters for their children that they needed.
Our study didn't take away from the primary care providers, but it helped them to do the reminder recall for their practices centrally using a state registry.
Her research shows that when a reminder message can be generated for an entire population, it takes the onus and the burden off of the primary care and pediatric practices.
In the counties where this was done centrally, about 19% of children who were not up to date became up to date versus about 13% in the practice-based recall state.
And the study also suggests that there's a cost savings as fewer children fall ill.
I can tell you that there have been some studies in recent years showing outbreaks related to a lack of immunization, particularly pertussis, measles, even H influenza. And, you know, you have one case of Haemophilus meningitis can cost tens of thousands of dollars.
A state health department-driven vaccination program that assists private practices in vaccine compliance for their patient population, improving vaccination rates of young and vulnerable children. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.